Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of I Pledge Allegiance. This week, we have on Scott, the founder of Argus. Scott's one of the most original thinkers I know about crypto gaming. And we have a lot of interesting topics to cover today, starting with gaming broadly, but also diving a little bit into what he's building at Argus and some of the contrarian opinions that he has about all of these topics, about rollups, about how crypto VCs are investing in gaming and what he thinks about that, and other things that he thinks about. So without further ado, welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me here.
I think most of the listeners here are probably following you on Twitter and have seen some of your tweets that have maybe gone viral. But for those that haven't, that aren't, can you give a quick, maybe like 60-second intro on just yourself and what Argus is?
Yeah, for sure. So like, my name is Scott. I got into crypto back in like 2013. I think this was middle school when I was like kind of browsing around subreddit, kind of like of Dogecoin. And this is like back in 2013 when Dogecoin was just first coming up. I initially thought it was just like funny, like how people are building these communities around these like meme coins, right? And so that's really kind of my first exposure to crypto. Fast forward to really 2017, 2018, this was really where there are more things happening on the blockchain, right? There are the CryptoKitties was just coming up, and then there's a lot of more things that you can do as a developer. There's more resources for Ethereum that you can develop smart contracts on and so forth. And so that's really kind of like when I kind of just, wow, crypto and blockchain and platform are really interesting. And I spent a lot of time kind of going into that rabbit hole. And so funnily enough, right after I graduated high school, I actually got a job offer to work as a software engineer in a crypto exchange in Asia. And so I withdraw from school to just kind of work in crypto for a year. And then eventually I went back to school. And that's really where I now have more time to just really explore what I want to do with regards to crypto, engineering, and so on and so forth. And this is also around the time when me and my friends co-created a game called Dark Forest. So Dark Forest really started off as this like applied research in zero knowledge proof. We were looking for a way that we can showcase zero knowledge proof in the wild. Back then, there wasn't really as much people who were like really trying to build on top of ZK. I know like right now, ZK is like one of the coolest things that people are trying to do, but it wasn't really like that back in the days. And so the documentations are very little, and there's only very few people who are like building zero knowledge proof applications. And so that's really kind of like why Dark Forest first started off. And the second thing that really led to Dark Forest was like this question on the back of our head of what if we build a game that is fully on-chain in the sense that every single game moves are happening on-chain. And so that is like kind of the core thesis of Dark Forest, right? We essentially build a fully on-chain game that uses zero knowledge proof as a way to provide incomplete information. And so for those of you who might not know about Dark Forest, it's essentially a fully on-chain RTS. So if you've played a game like EVE Online or Solaris, Dark Forest was largely inspired by those kind of games. So there's elements of strategy, there's elements of like these like space war, and people are all interacting in real time. And so that was what we needed, apparently, to got the attention of people within and outside of crypto towards these kind of like crypto gaming category. And like, remember, we launched Dark Forest in 2020, and actually we launched them during DeFi summer. So this was before all these like play to earn crypto games boom happened. And a lot of excitement that came with Dark Forest ended up spawning this new category of like games in crypto called the fully on-chain games. And some people like to call it autonomous world now. But like, yeah, that's really kind of the background of Dark Forest. Fast forward to 2022, we created Argus to basically build more games like Dark Forest, taking to kind of the learnings we had from Dark Forest. And one of those key learnings are that infrastructure for building fully on-chain games are not in a position where we think is ideal for building commercial scale game. And that's like why at Argus, one of our core R&D work is building something called the World Engine, which is a horizontally scalable roll-up architecture that is specifically designed for games from the bottom up. But like, yeah, other than that, at Argus, we also have a game studio. So we're not an infrastructure pick and shovel company. We are building these World Engine for our consumption as well. So we have a game studio that is building on top of the World Engine. But like, yeah, that's really kind of like how we see the space evolving as well. Like, we don't think that we need pick and shovel companies telling people this is like how you should build your game. We think that gaming companies should ask and like kind of should be the primary driver of like what kind of technologies we should build on an infrastructure side. And that's really kind of why we created kind of the World Engine as basically kind of an infrastructure that's in-house to like to Argus, but also we plan to open sources because we know a lot of people want to build more expressive on-chain games. And right now they're restricted to the abilities that current existing blockchain have.
Really helpful background, Scott. I've seen a few of your talks, and one thing you consistently mention is that Argus is first and foremost a gaming company, not an infrastructure or picks and shovels company, even though you are quite literally building a new piece of infrastructure in the rollup stack, the World Engine. So my question is, like, why make this distinction? Like, why do you care so much about making sure that people think of you as a gaming company first and foremost?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, right? And I think like the key reason is that gaming companies and pick and shovel companies in crypto or in general have a very different mindset, right? I think like if you go back to the 1980s, 1990s, when companies like Epic Games were just first coming up and like when Doom of the world are just first coming up, there's no dedicated game engine companies, right? There's no Unities of the world. There are gaming companies building engines that will allow them to build better games. And so the key differentiator here is that what is the objective function for these companies, right? So for gaming companies, their objective function is to just build a better game that will have more players, that provides great experience for their players using whatever technology tools that are necessary. And so that is really kind of the objective function for a gaming company. But if you kind of like take it from another angle, let's say like, you know, let's see this from the perspective of pick and shovel companies, their incentives are not to build necessarily better games. Their incentives are to sell pick and shovels. And so I think that leads to a lot of very interesting second order effects in crypto gaming where we're not in a position yet where even the game developers know what specifically they want. It's a very open-ended exploration of game design, exploration of like how we approach things, how do we scale things, how do we like make it easier for people to use. And so I just don't think we're ready for kind of infrastructure companies and dedicated pick and shovel companies to dictate to game companies in terms of like how they're supposed to approach things, because the game companies want that freedom. They crave that freedom to explore instead of getting prescribed of like what to do by pick and shovel companies. And we kind of draw an analogy back again to the gaming industry. In the 1980s and 1990s, all of the game engines are built by game studios, but eventually in like kind of the 2000s, Unity first came along, and now we have these like commercially available pick and shovel company building game engine. But it doesn't came until like the industry is so far along that we understand really what is needed and what it is that we need to build. And so the way that we kind of see it at Argus is right now is that, hey, we are at this exploration phase and we don't want to be restricted or we don't want to be limited by like, you know, what pick and shovel companies are telling us to do. And so we build our engines ourselves. And at the same time, we think about it, okay, like we can help other people build more amazing games as well. And then that's really why we decided that, hey, we should make the World Engine as something that is publicly accessible and other people can use outside of our game studio and really kind of push the needle forward for the crypto gaming space as a whole. Because if you kind of talk to anyone right now, everyone will give you the same problem. Okay, if you want to build this game, and they'll kind of excuse, we'll say, okay, the infrastructure doesn't allow us to do that. There is no company that allows us to do X, Y, and Z's. And that's really restrictive, right? Because like at the end of the day, gaming companies always crave for more creative canvas. And that's really what we want to optimize for here with the World Engine, with the infrastructure that we built. Like, how do we optimize for more creative canvas for game developers instead of like, okay, let's just like work within this small constraints that like kind of existing blockchains or existing pick and shovels grant to us. And so like, yeah, that's really the long answer there. I think the TLDR here is that, A, I think it's not the right time for dedicated pick and shovel companies to exist in crypto gaming. And B, is that I think there is a very large difference in mindset, the very difference and like a large difference in incentives that I think doesn't really align with the interests of the current crypto gaming space at the current time. There are some pick and shovel. I'm not saying that all pick and shovel companies in crypto is like that. I think there's definitely some part of crypto that have ossified more, that we already understand more about what we need. But for crypto gaming specifically, I think like the best infrastructure are going to be built by companies that are building games in-house and actually are in the ground suffering with the pain points and actually have strong incentives to build better games.
I guess to get a little bit more into the specifics, two of the highest profile projects that started out building games and building specifically for consumers are Dapper, which built NBA Top Shot, and then Axie, which built, obviously, Axie Infinity. Both of those companies have now, I don't know if pivoted is the right word, but they're now building their own infrastructure, their own blockchains. What do you think of those examples? Like, what do you think of this trend?
Yeah, so of course, I'm not really privy to like the specifics of their strategy. I've talked with some of these people, but I think the key thing here that I feel like the common mistake that I feel like a lot of these blockchain or crypto gaming companies that pivoted to building infrastructure, especially those that kind of do this in hindsight, is that they don't think very closely about the strategy for their infrastructure go-to-market, right? I think like one of the most common thing that I see with kind of a lot of these crypto gaming companies wanting to build infrastructure is that they became very prescriptive. They became very just like very top-down ecosystems, right? This is like how you're going to build your stuff. Like here's this walled garden of like ecosystem that you're going to need to use. You got to use our identity system. You got to use our launcher. This is like, you got to use their entire stack, right? And like all of them is going to be accessible within this like X-chain branding. And like, so it's very, very top down in nature. And the problem with that is that if you observe any successful crypto / blockchain ecosystem, like layer one or layer two, almost none of that are formed top down. Like no L2 companies or L1 companies are like, hey, here is an end-to-end walled garden solution. Use our stack, right? In contrast, what we've seen is that all of these protocols or blockchains that is successful are typically bottom-up in nature. I think the proper way of doing ecosystem development is to empower people to basically build things from the ground up, encourage these cross-pollination of ideas and protocols to form on top of like your ecosystem instead of prescribing things and building these like walled garden of ecosystem that you think that they will use. Like I think like basically taking more of the Android approach instead of like the iOS/Apple approach. And I think this is like what like Ethereum have done really well. Like you don't go to Ethereum and then Ethereum says like, hey, here's the identity, the tool that you need to use. Here's the wallet that you need to use. Here is the RPC provider that you need to use. No, like all Ethereum does is like, hey, Vitalik would make a blog post and like, hey, this is a cool idea. Someone should build it. And people ended up building it and people are building an ecosystem around it, right? And so Ethereum becomes this basically like credibly neutral playing field where everyone has a say, everyone's are on equal footing, and everyone feel the ability to really shape the future of the ecosystem, right? In contrast to a lot of these like gaming specialized like ecosystem, a lot of them are very top down. They're like identity tool that you need to use. You got to use the tokens and stuff like that. I think like with Argus, we want to take this like very bottom-up approach. We've seen the top-down approach failed consistently within crypto. I don't necessarily think these like very hands-on, very kind of like dictatory approach to ecosystem development works. I think like if you see some like, I don't know, this is not like private information. If you could just go on Twitter, you see a lot of like ex-Dapper Labs people or even current at Dapper Labs people just admit that Dapper's like, you know, like very hands-on involvement on Flow actually deters people from building on top of Dapper, like the Flow ecosystem, because it looks like it's a Dapper Labs blockchain, right? And that's really kind of, I think, a very interesting point. And so with the World Engine, one of the key things is that it's not a chain, right? It's like, it's more of like an SDK for people to spin up their own rollup. So at the end of the day, it is as bottom-up as it can be, because like all these like developers have full control in terms of like, okay, what do we want to customize these like basically white label chain to have? And like what kind of things that we want to build on top of it is fully in their discretion, right? Like, you know, Argus doesn't have control over what they're going to do with these chains. And I'm very excited about that, obviously, because it becomes this like open canvas for people to experiment with gamifying their blockchain. And like, this is something that I'm happy to talk about more. But essentially, we are very excited about like having more people building their own rollups that is fully customized to their use cases. And by doing that, they are able to create unique experiences to their players. and make the whole blockchain part not really as like a hindsight and actually a part of the core experience of the game itself. And of course, there are going to be like, okay, like a lot of people are going to talk to me about like, Scott, what do you think, what's about the user experience and so on and so forth. Again, at the end of the day, these are problems that are very solvable, right? I think people see blockchain as like these like inherent like UX issue that is like impossible to solve. But at the end of the day, it's all software, right? If you invest in resources to build on top of it, then you can make a lot of the user experience so much better. We have this thing at Dark Forest called the Burner Wallet, which makes it super easy for people to onboard into fully on-chain games when previously you have to download MetaMask and whatever. With Burner Wallets, everyone can just like play immediately within a minute. And that's really kind of like powerful tools to onboard these players. And I think the same way is going to happen with blockchain interactions in general as well beyond then gaming. And that's really kind of like why I'm fairly excited with just like kind of like actually using the blockchain as a core part of the gaming experience, not just like as a side effect that a lot of these crypto gaming companies are really treating it as to be. But yeah.
Super helpful, I think, to go into the nuances. I think it's really clear from talking that you think quite a lot about open source and for crypto broadly, but also drawing on the lessons from the decades of open source history and literature. I'm interested in open source. We talk a lot about it internally at Revery, but I'm less familiar with the history and evolution of gaming. So I'm curious, if you had to use one company or ecosystem in gaming that you personally use as a North Star, or maybe just a source of inspiration, what would that be? Have we seen this top-down versus ecosystem approach play out before?
Yeah, for sure. So I would say that trying to work in crypto games is very interesting because you have to incorporate lessons that you like people have learned from building traditional gaming companies, but you also need to incorporate learnings that you've seen from these like crypto, like kind of values on crypto history, right? So traditionally in gaming, people have built themselves around publishers, right? So you have kind of the EAs of the world, the Ubisoft of the world, you have the Epic Games of the world, you have the Valve of the world. And so all of these companies typically start with content. I think like this is kind of like one of the problems with a lot of, again, like these crypto gaming infrastructures, a lot of them wants to be a platform before they even have distribution to become a gaming distribution platform. So historically, for instance, if you've seen companies like, for instance, like Valve, right, that is like very well known for creating a gaming distribution platform called Steam, they didn't start by creating Steam. They started as a content company. They built an amazing game that a lot of people want to play. And they eventually created like Valve, like really first and foremost, to help them distribute their own game before it became like this giant marketplace for other people to publish their games as well. And so this is an example where I think like we can, in crypto games, can learn from the traditional gaming industry, right? I think at the end of the day, if you want to become a distributed platform, you want to be like, I don't know, like some, you know, publishing platform for games, you do have to start with great content to begin with. You can't really just like, oh yeah, we want to build a platform and then like expect that people will come. The problem here is, of course, it's a chicken and egg problem that with a very clear answer, which chicken or the egg comes first. It is just, I think it's always has been in gaming the case that games come first, the content comes first before a platform can be built around it. I don't know if you've seen like Fortnite recent move to like trying to platformize the Fortnite kind of like tools and like users and all of that. They didn't start with that UGC tool to begin with. They started with just building a great core game. And now they have like a large audience. And now they can expand to UGC and become a publishing platform for more Fortnite-based game developers. And so that's really kind of the key thing that we can learn from the gaming industry and game publishing industry in general that I think is like really powerful. And so it's not really a specific gaming company, but I think that is like for us, like very much the mantra at Argus. We basically acknowledge that we cannot build an ecosystem by just like telling, hey, here's an ecosystem. We have to build strong content to begin with for people want to build to on top of that ecosystem more and for people to want to basically kind of go to that ecosystem, right? And so that's really kind of why at Argus, we also have a game set. At the end of the day, we want to make sure that we have the great content with an ecosystem so that we can build this like strong network effect. And so like, yeah, that's really kind of the key part from the traditional game industry that we've learned. From crypto, of course, I think like I've already mentioned this before, but I think really kind of that bottom-up approach or ecosystem development is there's anything that you can learn from crypto history, is it's definitely kind of like their approach to ecosystem development. I don't think there is any industry outside of crypto that have the term ecosystem development being as real as it is in crypto. I think that is like, if any, that is like a very interesting developer relations kind of like mental model that I think like even everyone outside of crypto can learn from crypto. I think like, you know, a lot of kind of like these L1 and L2 ecosystem have the right approach, I think, like to ecosystem development, if they're thinking about it from a bottom-up approach where you're just encouraging people, empowering people to build certain things instead of like, oh yeah, just like, you know, prescribing things and throwing around money at them and like so on and so forth. And so those two things really are the north star, the guiding star for us. So for the gaming side, building content before we try to basically become like, you know, these like large ecosystem. And B is basically kind of taking this bottom-up approach to ecosystem development, empowering people to build things on top of you instead of trying to build this like top-down walled garden.
So basically, one, build a rich gaming experience, whether it's directly through the through user interaction or through content or just through a surrounding sort of experience. And then two is to let others experiment in an open way instead of, as you put it, top-down prescriptive, here's what you should build on our platform that we own. I think you explained it very simply, but like, this isn't rocket science. Like, I'm sure other people have tried this. Is the problem with previous crypto approaches the fact that there's tokens involved in some of these platforms? Like what has, in your eyes, stopped this industry from where it could be?
Yeah. So I think like I'll actually push back a little there in terms of like, I think like whether or not people have done it. I think like this is, as you say, it's not rocket science, right? But I think like historically what we've seen is that in crypto, people don't learn from history of like specifically in crypto games, right? It's like people would ignore the lessons that we've learned from like, you know, traditional games, right? And like people who are coming from gaming, they would ignore like the crypto history. And so this is always kind of the problem that I've seen with like new crypto gaming companies, is that like, oh yeah, like you'll see that like some of these companies will have strong traditional gaming background and they'll just kind of forget about the crypto part. And then like there's a lot of these people who came from the crypto part and then they ignore the traditional gaming kind of like experience, right? And I think that's really unfortunately why I feel like a lot of these crypto gaming companies ended up in the wrong direction. They don't really kind of consider the history and the market structure of like how things have formed in the past in inspiring their strategy in terms of like how they want to approach their go-to-market, how do you want to approach your product building, how do you want to approach the ecosystem development, and so on and so forth. And also I think like the second part is really that people kind of abuse the ability to growth hack things with incentives in crypto. I think a lot of people had this like illusion of like, oh yeah, we can do so many things because we can have access to crypto incentives. But like at the end of the day, like crypto incentives is like a double-edged sword, because like we've seen people in the crypto games like during the play to earn run try to really use the crypto incentives to growth hack their user account. They're trying to growth hack their retention numbers and so on and so forth. And historically what we've seen is actually that is so bad for the game developers, because that just like really destroys the quality of the data that you have, right? To give you a concrete example here, one of the things that we, like as a game developer, really invest a lot of time in is like building the data pipeline for the game so that we can find out where people are dropping off, where people are struggling with, where people are like bored, or like we have to, like how do we kind of build the next game better than the previous one? How do we do live ops with considering all the data and all of that? But the reality here is like with crypto incentives, like all of those data just means nothing, because like people, like even if the game is super bad, even the game is like super boring, people just continue to play because there are crypto incentives, right? And that's really kind of like why I think like a lot of these crypto incentives actually makes it harder for people to build crypto games with a proper feedback loop, right? And so I think like there is like that pitfall of like trying to lean too hard into crypto incentives, and that actually makes their life harder instead of easier in the long run. Sure, in the short term, they'll have impressive like numbers that they can show to investors, which I think like kind of like funny. Like if you've seen some of this data, like the number just looks so obviously wrong. But like a lot of crypto investors don't really have a way to reason, like, you know, about these numbers. And a lot of them doesn't have the context of crypto incentives, even though they're crypto investors. And like, because of that, they kind of confuse the signal with the noise. And so like, that is like really kind of my whole take about this, right? I think like, no matter how you think, like, how, like, wow, this is, like, so obvious. Like, why haven't anyone actually done this? the reality is people don't. And like for many different reasons. And like some of them are really just, oh yeah, they want to appeal to investors. Sometimes they're just like, oh yeah, they just like want to chase short-term wins. Some of them just like generally just don't know because they've never really kind of thought about it that much. But like, yeah, there are just like so many kind of different reasons on like why. Also, it's like super obvious and super straightforward that they don't really kind of take the same approach.
You mentioned a lot of crypto investors lacking the appropriate context or knowledge to, I think, understand some of these metrics. And I would say sometimes, like, I'm sure that's partially the case. Sometimes they do understand the causes and it's more just, hey, we've gotten capital from LPs. We have to deploy money, like, as another dynamic. But something we've talked about, Scott, is what else are crypto VCs wrong about gaming? Like, what other misconceptions, things do you commonly see that you read and you're like, this doesn't make sense, or these investors are like focused on completely the wrong thing. AAA games is one example.
So you brought a really good point there. I think like, again, with like crypto investing, there's like layers of incentives, right? I think like one of the key things here that we need to acknowledge is that like at the end of the day, like the investors are still accountable to someone, and like they will ask you like, okay, like, you know, why are you investing in this like companies? And they really want to kind of have something to show for. And I think like this like AAA trend, like to this trend towards like trying to invest in crypto gaming companies that are AAA, is one, again, there are multiple reasons for this, right? Is that A, I think there are just some crypto investors just that just thinks that AAA is the most surefire way into getting a game that the mass market wants to play. That is like one type of crypto investors. But like secondly, there are some part of the crypto investor or even in the same person, there's just like some part of them that feels that AAA is more showcaseable to the LPs, right? Because like the LPs are not, you know, sophisticated gaming investors. They're like, oh, look at this game. It looks so beautiful. They would go to LP Summit and like do a demo of the game and they would be very impressive and all of that. And so that's really kind of, again, like why there are strong incentives to build these like AAA games within crypto gaming, right? But you talk to gaming investors or like just people who understand the gaming business in general, you'll quickly learn that most of them will agree that AAA is not a silver bullet solution. There's a reason why not everyone in the gaming industry is trying to build AAA games. If AAA games are so good, why are game developers building AAA? In contrast, right, the gaming industry is filled with a lot of indie games that are really successful. There are publishing companies that are dedicated to funding and publishing indie games like Devolver and so forth. And so there is a clear answer. And the reason is like AAA really works well for companies that already have like a strong IP. It has a lot of these like strong publishing like distribution network. And all they want to really do is spend more money onto producing those games and have like a large multiples on that revenue and de-risk everything else, right? So a good example of a AAA game is like, for instance, like I made this Twitter thread recently about Legend of Zelda, right? I think like a lot of people are comparing these like basically Legend of Zelda game with crypto games. Like, why can't we just build a game like Legend of Zelda and then just like, oh, that would be like the killer crypto game, right? Well, unfortunately, it's not easy as that. For one, like Nintendo have insane amount of like publishing leverage. They have their platform like Nintendo Switch and like they natively have like full capabilities to advertise their game on. And they also have a lot of like rich backstory, a lot of rich respect, like and a lot of strong branding from the game community. And like the IP of Legend of Zelda is absolutely amazing, right? And so we don't really have that in crypto gaming right now. There's no companies in crypto games that have the publishing leverage of, you know, Nintendo. No one really have an IP as strong as Legend of Zelda. So pouring a shit ton of money onto like this like kind of AAA games wouldn't really give you the same output as you would expect as if it were done by Nintendo, right? Even if you have the exact same gameplay, you have the exact same looks without the Zelda name, without the Zelda characters, you wouldn't have the same mileage as like, you know, Nintendo. And so that is really why it doesn't really make sense for crypto gaming companies to spend a lot of money, AAA amount of money in a single title. Because the market structure is just like very different, right? You don't have as much capital as the AAA companies, and you don't have the publishing capabilities of the AAA companies. You don't have the IP of the AAA companies. And all of that is necessary in making the AAA model make sense. This is like why you see like, you know, Call of Duty just keeps like basically reinventing the wheel, like basically just keep doing the same thing again and again, and they make money from that. Because that's like how the AAA industry works. You innovate as little as possible maybe you like improve the graphics, you spend more money in getting like new narrative, you invest more money in getting like some like famous actor to do the voice acting and so whatsoever. And that is like kind of the input that you put into AAA, and then you get the output as kind of like revenue multiples of the budget that you spend on that kind of title, right? They're so de-risked such that spending a lot of the money on a single title would make sense, but it wouldn't really make sense for a new crypto gaming company.
Just jumping in a little bit, I feel like the most prominent but also just annoying example of AAA games is to me the EA with FIFA and Madden, where they have licenses with those sports leagues and it's locked in. So they know they'll launch a new version every year and it's the exact same game every single year with no changes. But I guess one question though is, again, I don't mean to pick on specific companies, but like, I'm sure Dapper thought of this, right? This was their approach. Like, hey, let's raise a lot of money. Let's get specific licenses and partnerships with brand name sports leagues like the NBA and the NFL. Let's advertise and get distribution and market ourselves to consumer. Like, those are some of the pieces of that AAA puzzle. So I guess my question would be like, why didn't that playbook work?
Yeah. So at the end of the day there is like, it comes down to what is the core content, right? I think like with Dapper, they raise a lot of money. Like they licensed the NBA IP with Top Shot and so on and so forth. But it's not really a game, right? It's a collectible. And like people were like, at the end of the day, speculating on those collectibles. And it will go on to for so long until like, basically, you're essentially kind of just like, yeah, there's no value in speculating onto these like NBA Top Shot assets. And that's really kind of where you lose all the remaining attention, right? So at the end of the day, it all comes down to just like what kind of content that will kind of draw attention to your game, right? Because like you can spend a lot of money in marketing, but if you spend a lot of money in marketing, but no one is really appealed by your content, what it is that you are trying to ask your users to spend their attention on, then it's really kind of like a lost cause, right? I think we've seen a lot of these kind of like, basically a lot of these like, games in the past, they're just like, okay, they spent a lot of money on advertising, but all the, like, okay, sure, the user will try it out for a few days and then they all churn out. And so that's like, for me, for anyone that is in gaming and have done like this free to play live ops based game, users churning quickly is a huge L because like they're not gonna like actually fulfill your like, you know, lifetime value expectations and stuff like, and so on and so forth. And I think we see that as the case where like, these companies like Dapper and all of that, even though they like are able to spend a lot of money on this, the ability to kind of like create content that retain for like longer periods of time and like especially not something that is replicable because like, okay, people stop being interested in the content, that becomes a problem, right? I think like at the end of the day, sure, they can build, let's say like hypothetically, a crypto gaming company raised a bunch of money, built a clone of like, you know, 2K, build an identical basketball game. It's not a given that people will suddenly just switch to this new game that is like a knockoff of 2K, right? Even they've spent a lot of money and like they invest a lot in distribution, because at the end of the day, unless you like basically compete with the brand name and like network effect of like, and like the, you know, like all of these that EA already has, then you don't really get that kind of like benefit, right? And I think like, again, people can raise a lot of money in crypto games, but like you have to just realize that EA will have more money. Like these companies are absolute giants. And I think that, like, I'm not trying to say that as like a doomer thing, oh, like crypto gaming is going to get wrecked by EA and like 100%, like all of that. I think it's just like requires us to think in a very different way. Or one of the things that I really like to draw an analogy from the kind of traditional gaming industry is like how at every gaming exists in cycles too. I think like, but people like seem to think that gaming is this like, you know, since the 1980s, like gaming have been like the same thing. But no, gaming have their cycles as well. You know, in the 1980s, we have this like coin-op era where everyone's just like playing arcade games where they put a quarter in and you get like so 5 minutes or 10 minutes of fun. And then like in like the late 1990s and like early 2000s, you have this like online gaming uprising. You see the NCSoft of the world and kind of like Valve of the world came into prominence in 2010. In the late 2000s, 2008, around that, Zynga came about and social games was the thing. In like early 2010s, you have these mobile gaming companies coming into the industry and becoming a giant themselves, right? At every of these cycle, you have these like kind of giants that are able to compete with the incumbents by doing something that is new and kind of leveraging a new medium, a new canvas, a new method of publishing that was basically unexplored by the kind of incumbents, right? And so there is kind of an opportunity here in crypto to become like something like this as well, where like people can like lean into the things that make crypto special and these like novel strategies that you could find in crypto to basically be able to compete with incumbents. But you're not going to beat the incumbents in their playing field. You're not going to be able to beat the mobile games, like, you know, by trying to build a mobile gaming company in crypto that just replay the same playbook that mobile game has, right? Because at the end of the day, you're going to be outspent. You're going to be like, you know, your IP is going to be outcompeted by them. And so there is a lot of strong incentives for you to lean into these things that makes your platform novel, right? And that's like really kind of how you draw attention. And this is like why I think like a lot of these developments in VR, a lot of these developments in AI, a lot of these developments in crypto are all fascinating things for gaming investors, because historically these are like what will enable new publishers, new large gaming company to basically come up from the ground up to challenge the incumbents. Like, you know, the key thing here I'm trying to make is that it's not like crypto gaming is, oh yeah, it's, you just give up now, EA is going to kill you. The point here is like, if you're trying to challenge EA with the EA playbook, then you're going to get wrecked. But if you're trying to compete with EA with the crypto playbook, then you'll have like a lot of kind of advantage that will allow you to become this like unique player in the space that, like, you know, basically will now sits within the ranks of like the large game publishing companies that have done that before, right? Because like EA have been around for like for a while now. And like we've seen like these mobile gaming companies that actually trailblazed the pack before even EA came into mobile games, right? And what I'm trying to say here is that we can do this for crypto as well. We just need to stop trying to like copy the same playbook of like, you know, the previous generation of games, because again, it's not your playing field, right? You know, stay in your home turf, do what you do best. And like, of course, you should take the learnings from them, but you shouldn't copy their playbook. It needs like a new playbook to really be special and be able to stand out in your home turf that you have an advantage on.
Yeah, no, I think really well said. My general sense of, I think there's been over the past 2-3 years, like a lot of investment into these AAA games from a crypto side and trying to create crypto native AAA gaming companies. And I'm still open to the idea that a few of them might succeed. But I think it's going to be an uphill battle and it's going to be really difficult. But I still think some of them might do well. But my sort of general sense is, like, as a whole, it's an inefficient investment of capital. It's like billions of dollars being deployed. You might get lucky, right? But it's not like, because you're playing the game that EA and all these other people are playing, it's just like not a capital asymmetric bet.
Yep, you brought a good point there. I'll just kind of comment on this real quick, is that like, I think like there will be games that are successful that are taking this kind of AAA approach. However, these are not going to be kind of games that are going to drift venture returns, right? Because like, sure, you can invest a game and like it became a hit single title game. But if they're incapable of building kind of long-term publishing leverage and being kind of like a unique and like a standout company that have their own like unique playbooks and like unique insight on like how to do things, then these are not companies that drive venture returns in traditional games. I think like if you see in traditional games, there's a lot of really great like single title game developers, but really, at the end of the day, that the larger multiples, like the kind of the companies that you see are going public on the stock market or companies are just creating a lot of value in gaming, are publishers. And the way that publishers perform are not by just like, okay, like, I'll give you a lot of money, create a good single title. These are kind of the business of game developers, but this is not the playing field of like what game publishers operate on. And so, like, yeah, I do think like maybe we'll have like one of these AAA game that maybe like have like a mediocre success, like, you know, they found their niche and so on and so forth. But the question here is whether or not they will be able to build like long-term publishing leverage. And if they're just like basically becoming a regular, like, you know, AAA game development studio, then unfortunately they'll just become like another subsidiary of EA. They're not going to be the EA competitor themselves. It's very important to kind of really highlight that differences, right? Because like there are plenty of like successful game studios in the gaming industry. And this is really kind of like where like this is like a lot of reason why M&A is like very active and crypto games, in the traditional gaming, because there are just these game development studios that produce a great single title game, but they don't have long-term publishing leverage to really become an independent publisher of their own. So they just become acquired by like these like larger companies, right? And like, that's really kind of like where I see a lot of these like crypto AAA games ending up. It's like, oh yeah, they'll just get acquired by like maybe kind of like a larger company, which is like kind of like a win case, but it's not going to be venture returns, right? Because the scale that we're operating in, if you want to drive venture returns, if you want to be like a generation defining company, is like very different with like the incentives of like the single tile studio. So like, yeah, that's a really interesting point.
Maybe to wrap up this discussion on AAA games versus alternative approaches, what is the answer then? Because you mentioned, okay, crypto needs to find out and leverage its specific benefits to build like a loyal crowd and a loyal native user base, not just cater to like mainstream who occasionally touch crypto for the sake of touching crypto. Like, how do you actually, and again, we're getting into the Argus, sort of why you're doing this and all that. So you don't have to share everything, but to the extent that you're comfortable like talking about it, like how do you think about the winning approach? My first question is like, when did you realize what this approach was and what is the approach?
Yeah, so I think like the mental model here with regards to kind of gaming is it all comes down to attention, right? I think like a lot of people in crypto games are very fascinated by this idea of fun. It seems like people are obsessed with this idea of like, okay, fun is going to solve all the crypto gaming's problem. The reality here is that if you kind of take into consideration of the grand landscape of gaming, fun is not what we're scarce with. What we're scarce with is attention. There are so many fun games out there. If you just go to Steam Marketplace, you browse around the indie section and just select a random game, odds are you're going to find a fun game. So fun is not the scarce resource. The scarce resource is attention. And I see crypto as a way for us to create a new hook, right? I think like each game needs to have like a unique appeal to a certain kind of audience that they want to appeal to. And I think like crypto has a lot of really interesting promises in creating these new hooks for the larger audience, right? And of course, like, I think like I'm very much in the camp of, like, I think like the lowest hanging fruit is to create hooks that are interesting to the crypto audience. But in the grand scheme of things, there are a lot of really interesting hooks that you can like use in crypto that appeals to a broader audience, right? To give you an example, I'm not a big fan of play to earn, this whole play to earn narrative and so on and so forth. I think it's a broken incentives. However, you have to acknowledge that these crypto incentives spark was at some point a very interesting hook for the larger mass market audience, right? And so that is kind of like really what I feel like is interesting for crypto explore more, is to find these hooks that are appealing to not only people in crypto, but also like people in the mass market as a whole. I think it's very dismissing to just say that, hey, crypto is not going to be an interesting hook for the gamers, and therefore we shouldn't even build like crypto elements into the game. Well, the only advantage that you have like as a crypto gaming company is the crypto part. Otherwise, you're just going to be the same as like all these mobile gaming companies or PC gaming companies, right? And so that is really what I'm most excited about with like what we do at Argus and what we do through our R&D lab, is to really create more design space for these hooks to be kind of like created, right? So we need to stop crutching on NFTs, because I think like we're just like beating a dying horse here. Like, I think like all these NFTs like all just looks the same way. It's implemented in the same way. They integrate with the game in the same way. So it no longer has become like a unique attention grab. Even like back in the days, CryptoKitties became fascinating because it was like doing NFTs for the first time. But like the key thing here is like you can't keep abusing the same hook forever, because at some point you'll just like look the same as every other game. And so that is the same thing what I think with crypto, right? Is I feel like you have to like find a way to basically stand out from the pack. Like, let it be like, okay, maybe you want to explore using crypto incentives for UA, or you want to explore using some like a fully on-chain game elements to build a novel gameplay experience for the users. A lot of people have UGC that they were previously unable in their like, you know, Web2 game counterparts. So these are kind of like possible like design space for building attention onto your game, right? And so there are, of course, like other kind of ways of building attention to your game, which is by like, let's say, for instance, experimenting with new core game loop, experimenting with new combinations of game design. And all of these are all valid ways to build attention. But at the end of the day, like, I think like it's important to really acknowledge that we're not going to get where we want to be by just like copying AAA game, because the AAA games get their attention not from these novelties, but they are basically getting their attention from brand dominance, from like kind of distribution dominance, by having the money to spend to basically publish their games and like have like a high fidelity graphics. what we should be learning from is actually the indie gaming industry. The indie gaming industry is very interesting because they don't have the money to outcompete these AAA games in terms of like quality of graphics or even production budget and whatsoever. But they basically stand out by having novel gameplay experiences, by having interesting new narratives. These are what we can learn from kind of the indie gaming industry. And I think crypto games are much closer to indie games than it is to AAA right now. Like, we need to find a way for us to stand out by kind of other means that is not spending $50 million on a single title game. And that's really kind of like where I think a lot of these crypto elements became really interesting. And I wish that we are able to see that more. And I hope that World Engine, the SDK they're rolling out Argus, are going to unlock a lot of these design spaces.
That was going to be one of my follow-up questions. Like, do you think of sort of Argus as an indie game developer or just like inspiration in general? You raise money for Argus. Can indie game developers become huge? Like, and it isn't a leading question. I genuinely am not familiar with the indie gaming, sort of how that's played out. Is there a path? Like, what's the story that you tell?
Yeah, so I think like this is not even a story or anything, right? I think like this leads back to really distinction of like game studio versus game publishers, right? I think like at the end of the day, I think if you're only trying to be a single title indie game company, then it's not probably a venture scale bet, right? It's really kind of like a very one-off thing. And the key thing here for us is that we're leaning towards basically becoming a gaming publisher, right? I think at the end of the day, we want to basically go beyond a single title. We want to find a model that is scalable across many games and being able to execute on that relentlessly. And so the key answer here is that I don't think the exact model of like being an indie game studio would really make sense to be like a venture scale company. However, there are things to learn from this industry just because that's really kind of the state of the industry right now. And so I think it's also important to think about that at the end of the day, all gaming companies, all these large publishers, all started by being an independent game company. When Steam was just first starting out, like when Valve was first starting up, they're not like AAA publishers. They are like, you know, indie gaming companies building these kind of games that eventually became very popular. They build up their balance sheet. They build up their playbooks. They build up their distribution leverage. Eventually, they become a game publisher, right? The question here is not whether or not the indie games are like a venture scale bet. The question here is whether or not these like supposedly indie companies have a clear pathway into becoming venture scale or becoming a game publisher. And so that is really kind of like what the venture, like, you know, there's a lot of thematic gaming funds these days that are investing. And a lot of those are really kind of making a bet that, hey, if we invest in this game studio, eventually they might be a multi-title game publisher. They will find their unique kind of like publishing leverage and they will become a billion-dollar company. Of course, again, like I'll just caveat there that different gaming funds have very different thesis and like how they want to see their exit outcome for their investments. But if you seek, you know, traditional technology funds that are investing in games, like for instance, like, you know, Roblox, right? Like Roblox started off as this kind of more like single title. Like they're obviously indie because they're not working with like EA or whatsoever. But eventually they become this like large publishing platform with a strong publishing leverage, right? And so I think that's really kind of how I see crypto games are really evolving. I think it really comes down to like, hey, can you distill a unique publishing leverage? Can you distill a unique pathway for you to become like a publishing powerhouse? And that's really kind of the path that Argus wants to take, right? We're not going to be a single title game, like kind of like single title company. I just don't think that is, like, it's not the most capital efficient way of like doing things. Of course, there's a lot of people that are basically raising money for basically becoming a single title studio company. And I respect that. And I think like there might be these efforts that turns out into like really, very successful game. However, it is not the playing field that we want to be in, because we want to be like a generational gaming company. And like to be on that, we need to build long-term publishing leverage, not just like a good single title game.
I think the TLDR of really the past 30 minutes or so is crypto needs to find its own unique wedge into gaming. It can't rely on just copy and pasting strategies from before and playing those same games. It's not clear what that specific wedge is today yet, but there are some ideas, which I think leads to the next section of the podcast, which talks a bit more about Dark Forest, sort of the early days of Dark Forest and just the philosophy there.
Yeah, for sure. So basically, the brief TLDR of Dark Forest is that Dark Forest is a fully on-chain MMORPGs game built on kind of the EVM blockchain. And so the keyword here is fully on-chain, right? So in contrast to a lot of these like crypto games that are only using kind of NFTs on-chain, Dark Forest game is really fully on-chain for every single facet of it. If you make a game move, you, let's say, conquer a new planet, or you, like, let's say, mine an artifact from, like, let's say, a planet, then it's all like happening fully on-chain. And the interesting thing about that is it really opens up this new novel gameplay experience to like composability and interoperability. The game essentially now has like an open API by default, and people can build on top of that. This is very fascinating from a game designer, a game developer standpoint, because now you have a blank canvas for emergent behavior to form around. So like, I think the key thing here that I really like to highlight is that I feel like the future of like crypto games are going to be a spectrum. Like one end of the spectrum is going to be the fully on-chain games of the world. And there's going to be the other side of the spectrum that is only using a minor part of the game on-chain, like for instance, like NFTs. But even if you go to like the kind of like the only NFTs on-chain part on the other end of the spectrum, you already see emergent behavior forming, right? Like when people build NFT marketplaces around these, like, you know, games assets, when people build like a lending market for these game assets, those are forms of emergent behavior. And so the key primitive here is that the more that you have on chain for your game, the more space for emergent behavior can form around your game, right? So for the elements that are on chain, it will be easily composable. People are able to interact with smart contracts and all of that. And that opens up a large design space for people to build primitives on top of your game. And so that's really what is exciting about like more on-chain games element, right? And so I think the key thing here that I'm trying to kind of advocate for is to basically not think about like fully on-chain games as like this, oh yeah, you either have to be fully on-chain or you're not like kind of truly fully on-chain. It's really, again, like really just like extreme ends of the spectrum. I think I'm particularly very excited about people building games that are in between. Like there are like some of them are off-chain and that's perfectly fine. But there are more things that are on-chain than beyond just the NFT assets, so that we can explore more design space for emergent behavior. And the reason for that is because emergent behavior is a very fascinating way to build long-term playability for the game. I think like as game developers and designers, we fascinate a lot about the idea of players being able to enjoy playing the game even after years to come. There's this concept called the forever games, right? Like people who are like constantly like playing the game for many years and they're not getting bored of it. And so most of the forms of like forever games that we've seen are currently with competitive games. Like you see games like Valorant, games like Counter-Strike, games like Dota 2 or League of Legends. These are forever games because they're an infinite design space for meta gameplay, right? For people to combine different heroes, to try new combos, or maybe adjust to a new buff or patch. And the reality here with a lot of these like live service games, like these games that want to last for many years, is that they're looking for new spaces, for new design spaces for us to create long-term replayability. And I do think that having emergent behavior to through on-chain elements are kind of like the space where we can explore more of these like emergent behaviors, right? For allowing players to build a rich meta gameplay experiences beyond just the core game itself. And so that's really what I'm particularly excited about with like allowing these like open API system for games, is because it will allow basically the players themselves to create more content and that makes the game exciting. And so that's really kind of my fully on-chain game thesis. I know there are people out there who are like excited about fully on-chain because it's like a permanent layer. It's like a decentralized and fully uncensorable game and so on and so forth. And I think that's really cool too. However, at the end of the day, like, you know, seeing this from a practical standpoint, seeing this from a perspective of a game developer that maybe is not as deep into this like decentralization or like permanence or like rabbit hole, I think there is really strong case for like having kind of like more on-chain game elements just from these like emergent meta gameplay standpoint.
I'm not sure how many of the listeners to this pod have actually played Dark Forest. I imagine not many, but who knows? What was unique in ZK plus Dark Forest that no other game in crypto or out of crypto could do?
Yeah, so I think like what I would actually say is that you don't really need ZK, right? I feel like ZK part is really tools in a toolbox. It's really a means to an end. The cool thing about using ZK for Dark Forest is that now we have a game where even the game developers themselves, the game servers, don't even know where the planets are. It's like fully private. And so it's an interesting nerd snipe on its end, right? A lot of people were really fascinated about the way that the ZK primitives are used However, it's not really kind of the key part that makes kind of Dark Forest like exciting. So the key part that makes a lot of people are playing the game or building on top of the game are excited about is the ability for you to build these like smart contracts that directly interact with the game logic. So for example, we had this one guild who was playing Dark Forest called DF DAO, who built a smart contract called the Astral Colossus that allows them to pool their resources and like basically play the game together as like, you know, these like large giant colossal, like, you know, guild, right? And so that was like really fascinating. And like a lot of people were building things like information marketplaces around the game. People are building like different variety of gameplay extensions. Those are things that are, I feel like, really powerful. The ZK part, again, is really a means to an end. We want to build a fully on-chain games where we have hidden private states. And without zero knowledge proof, you're not able to achieve that. And so that is like why we incorporate ZK elements into the game. But like, yeah, at the end of the day, we see like ZK, we see like, you know, maybe even AI or LLMs or even like these variety of like primitives that we're going to find in crypto, like for instance, like verifiable random functions, as really kind of tools in a toolbox for us to explore new game design, like, you know, or gameplay experiences. But at the end of the day, the synthesis here is the open API. It's really kind of like having this like core gameplay rules that are enforced on chain. However, people can build on top of them using smart contracts. And that's really kind of like the key appeal for like on-chain games. The different cryptography primitive you can use for on-chain games are really means to an end, not really kind of like what we build on-chain games for.
I think the point about APIs is especially timely given what's happening with Reddit right now. They started charging for API usage and a lot
of their... Yeah, man. I mean, I'm going to miss Apollo.
Yeah, no, I was playing around with Apollo yesterday and it just struck me with Apollo how rich the experience was. To me, it was actually, there were too many features. It was like a little overwhelming. So that's why I don't use it, but I can see, again, I think that's just like shows the importance of having third parties and open APIs.
Yep.
What did that process look like? So you were involved in Dark Forest, I believe as a co-founder, like what happened to Dark Forest? Is it still a thing? Where did people go? What did that transition look
like? Yeah, so Dark Forest, I think at this point, become really kind of a community experiment, right? I think Dark Forest was really the game that basically succeeded after even the like kind of core team wasn't really actively developing on it anymore. So of course, like we're now working at Argus, building on my own thing. But Dark Forest right now is fully driven by essentially the community. We see kind of like people basically building kind of like new gameplay modes of Dark Forest. There's this game called Dark Forest Arena, which is basically Dark Forest, but they make it more MOBA instead of RTS. And these are really kind of the most fascinating thing that I've just basically been able to see unfold within this past few years. And like, yeah, that's really like what we are really excited about as well with the kind of Dark Forest and an experiment. It's like really an experiment of like how the community can take a game beyond than like what it is like when it first just started out. Essentially having this like emergent game launches onto itself. And this is all possible because Dark Forest was open source and Dark Forest had basically like a contract architecture that really affords these like extensions and modifications and allowing the game to basically empowering, right, the game community to build their own spin of the Dark Forest game. I don't know if this is the approach that every game studio is going to take. However, I do see this as a very interesting experiment. And we've actually seen this happen with traditional games and like not crypto games recently too. I don't know if you've played a game called Duelist. It's a very fascinating indie game. I'm like a big fan of it. And they recently also open sourced their whole IP. It's literally now in public domain. It's like CC0. And now like they see the developers community are remixing the game, building a new version of the game, adding new gameplay content, even beyond the game developers maintaining it. And so I'm like particularly fascinated about these like kind of experiments of open sourcing games such that the players can continuously extend and like actually perpetuate the IP beyond the core game itself. And like I'm actually excited to kind of just like see how these will evolve and like how this might lead to a new or novel game business model. But I think like for now, it's really kind of more of a fascinating more than anything. We're not necessarily leaning into that, but I do think it's like something that is like worth watching.
One thing that's really interesting about Argus is the tech stack, which combines elements of Cosmos and Ethereum. There's not many people that I think Like, I've had people on this podcast from Ethereum. I've had people on this podcast from Cosmos. There is an intersection, but like, I would say the number of people and companies that have gone deep, truly deep in both is not big. How did you decide on just like the stack for Argus?
Yeah. So I think that's a very good question. And like the answer here is because like you've like watched me on Twitter when on this like full Cosmos kind of like deep dive, like kind of just exploring the entire space, talking a lot with Cosmos community, engaging all the Cosmos community. And what I learned is that Cosmos have a lot of things right. They had a lot of ideas in terms of like how application specific and specialized blockchains can open up the doors for novel applications, right? Right now, like a lot of the people have a very Ethereum centric model of like how the blockchain works, right? You have these like L1 or L2 that is generalized and you just deploy, everyone deploy onto this like shared L1 or L2. And that's really kind of the Ethereum centric model. Cosmos have a very different model. Their approach is like they're very big on application specific infrastructure. They want to build a state machine. They want to build like, you know, configurations of a blockchain that lends itself very well to a very specific kind of like use cases. And so that is really kind of the key learnings that I found in kind of a Cosmos, right? And so when I was building Argus, I was like kind of like exploring the space and realized that, hey, I think rollups, Ethereum rollups can benefit from the learnings that Cosmos have with application-specific blockchains. And really the world engine and the kind of the rollup SDK that we're building at Argus really kind of like leans onto those application-specific affordances really hard. So like one of the things that we do with the rollup engine is we built a state machine. We built something called the game shard that is specifically designed to run fully on-chain game computation. And so as a result, that just makes the blockchain essentially kind of these like game backend server and makes it super powerful. You can do really amazing, fascinating stuff on top of it that otherwise you wouldn't be able to do with a normal blockchain. That's really what I'm particularly excited about, really this exploration of like specialization of rollups. With rollups, you have the ability to launch these new application-specific chain easily, right? Like the problem with Cosmos is like if you want to launch a new chain, you have to like basically bootstrap your validator set, you're going to have the token emissions and so on and so forth. With rollups, you don't have that problem anymore. And so I do feel like these kind of like synthesis between the learnings of Cosmos and the learnings of like rollups will actually lead to a renaissance of application-specific blockchain. You will see people experimenting more with this specialization of rollups. And that's really what I'm like excited about the most. I gave this talk recently at DBA's Research Day in New York. And the key takeaway from my talk really is that there is a very interesting design space for rollups that is specialized to do a certain things. And of course, I think there is an argument for why like you still want and need a generalized blockchain, like a generalized rollup. But for specific applications, especially consumer applications, there is a very strong argument on like why you should have your own like specialized chain. And then we see this not only with like gaming, but we see this with decentralized social. I think there's just a lot of different ways that you can architect a blockchain that actually leans the nature of interaction, the nature of use for that specific blockchain or that specific rollup. And like, yeah.
I want to sort of take a step back and look at rollups from 1,000 feet high. We have rollup infrastructure, we have rollup as a service providers, we have app builders, and we can talk all day long about the nuances, trade-offs between these different projects. But like, at the end of the day, it's like application builders not picking providers based off of these decisions. For the most part, there's exceptions. They're picking them based off of ease of access, distribution, and branding. And it all sort of reminds me of the L1 wars, you could call it, from like 2019 to 2021, when like to me it's extremely similar, and there's some differences, like there's some new dynamics involved, but like I'm curious if you think that's a fair assessment and just your thoughts more generally on the meta of where we are in rollups today.
Yeah, so I think like the mental model that I really like to use when talking about these rollups kind of like market structure is like basically kind of drawing the analogy to computer operating systems, right? I think like right now with rollups, there's basically three distinction, right? There's like the kernel, there's the distro, and then there's like basically the cloud provider. So like, for instance, here, like in the computer operating systems, you have the Linux kernel. And then on Linux kernel, you have different distribution. You have Ubuntu, there's Fedora, Red Hat Linux. And then there are like AWS or Google Cloud of the worlds that is running these like operating systems on their server and providing that to the kind of like, you know, the developers, right? And so I think the same thing are forming with rollups as well right now. So you have the kernels, which are going to be things like OpenStack that is developed by Optimism. There is also Rollkin that is developed by Celestia's like kind of ecosystem. That is the kernel, right? It really kind of provides you and expose you with the basic functions of a rollup in a similar way that like the kernel of an operating system, like the kernel of an operating system exposes you to the basic functions of a computer. Like, let's say you want to do memory allocation and whatsoever. That is kind of like the lowest part of the stack in rollups right now. Going up one layer, there are the distros, right? The distributions of the rollup. These are really the package combination of really kind of a flavored version of the kernel. They have these customizations and whatsoever around the kernel, right? And so, for instance, with like normal operating systems, you have Ubuntu, which is like a Linux distribution that is specifically designed for consumer use cases for it to be used in, let's say, a desktop computer. Or like it's also used in like servers, but basically like a lot of people treat Ubuntu as this like consumer friendly distro. And then in rollups, this is like where we see a lot of different variants, but a lot of them unfortunately right now are fairly generalized, right? Like there is kind of, oh yeah, this is like the distro, but it's really just like, okay, it's like basically EVM on top of like Rollkit. It's like, oh, CosmWasm on top of Rollkit. It's like, I don't know, another flavor of rollup on top of the OpenStack sequencer. But it's all of these kind of generalized things, right? We take a very different approach here with a World Engine. So World Engine is a distribution of like distribution for a rollup that is specifically designed for gaming use cases. And we make it much more specialized because instead of like basically building a distro around a specific virtual machine or like a specific state machine model, we create our distro on top of like a very specific user in mind. And I think like we kind of joke around this and like, in the office is kind of these like word cell meme of like, we call it the basically a user-centric rollup, right? We think about like what the user persona looks like and we build the use cases, the VM, the state machine, the trade-offs around that specific user persona, right? So instead of like just like, oh yeah, let's do EVM on this rollup, we're like, okay, what does the game developer will need? What does the game players will need? And create a distro around that specific user persona, which for us, we feel that this is like the part that makes sense the most because if you have a user persona in mind, you are able to make trade-offs that other rollup distributions are not able to because they are just trying to appeal to everyone. So that's really kind of like where we are. The World Engine SDK is really a distro. It's a rollup distro that allows people to build rollups that are specifically designed for gamers and game developers. One part above that stack is really kind of the cloud providers, right? In traditional kind of like computing industry, there is like, you know, Amazon and Google Cloud was providing these cloud compute resources. In rollups, we have the rollup as a service companies. They are basically spinning up these like rollups using the existing rollup distros such that it is accessible for like various rollup consumers to have their own dedicated rollup without having to run the infrastructure themselves. And so that's really kind of like how I see the market structure of like rollups forming. There are people who want to do multiple layers of it. But like right now, I think people are starting to find they're part of the stack and specializing more on that.
To me, the natural follow-up question to this analogy of kernel to distro to cloud provider is, what is the most powerful entry point, right? In any market structure, there's certain points that are going to capture the most value. In the crypto, I'll just use an example, in the crypto prime brokerage stack, it's trading. Custody is a loss leader. Staking can be lucrative depending on the market, but trading is where all the money is, trading itself. So how do you think about it here? Like, where are the margins?
Yeah. In my opinion, like if we only kind of take this consideration from the infrastructure side of, from like basically one thing, from the lens of a pick and shovel company, I do think the margins are in rollup as a service. Although like, you know, the key thing here is that infrastructure plays are, especially in like crypto, are economies of scale, right? I mean, like it's economies of scale in like even the traditional computing, right? And so the margins right now in rollup as a service is actually compressing. And I think that's a good thing for, like, you know, the future of rollups itself, because like now we can have rollups getting spin up for much, much cheaper than it was for like last year, when like people were just still figuring out how to like spin up their own like application specific rollups, right? And so right now I would say there is no margin in like kernel level, because like with the kernel, what you want to do is like have more people building on top of that kernel ecosystem, right? It's going to be this open source public good. And the distro layer, I would argue that there is actually margins, but it is really kind of like a strategic question for whether or not you want to like do like a licensing scheme for your distro. And for us, we just don't see that as a very appealing strategy. Because at the end of the day, what we really want to do, our end game with Argus, is to build this internet of games. We want to have as many people basically building their games on like World Engine based blockchains. And so we don't want to gatekeep like kind of the World Engine. We want more developers to be building on top of it. And so we're not looking to make any margins at all at the on the World Engine. And this is like why, again, going back, that we're not a pick and shovel company, we're a gaming company. The goal of World Engine is to just build better games. And so I don't think for World Engine there's going to be any margins on this. Like, it's like really just like a tool, so a means to an end for us to build better games. And we'll capture value by building and publishing great games, not by peddling World Engine as an infrastructure play. That's really kind of like how we see it.
It also be a bit of an oxymoron if World Engine was heavily licensed and expensive to use.
Right? Yeah. So again, like, building infrastructure entails to a very different business, right? Like, the moment that you are like selling this as an infrastructure product, then you'll have to be an enterprise B2B SaaS company. You need to have like solutions engineer. You need to have like miscellaneous kind of like supporting functions within an organization to support your enterprise B2B model. And again, we don't really want to distract ourselves with being that. We want to be a gaming company. And a lot of these, again, are all very tempting. It's very tempting, like at Derek, to like, oh yeah, like one day we'll just be a pick and shovel company. We'll license the World Engine, blah, blah, blah. But like, I had this literally printed out on my like desk. I put it on a post-it note on my computer that we are not a pick and shovel company. And like, if you see my pitch deck, when I was raising, I had this one giant slide that just say, we are not a pick and shovel company. And like, we intend to just like stay true to that, because at the end of the day, we don't see our like, you know, end game, the best path forward in pushing the plot of like crypto games, as like Scott building like a pick and shovel company. I think the way that we can push a plot is building this as a public good, building this as kind of an open source project that people can build upon, people can build an ecosystem around. And that's really why we are very adamant about not being a pick and shovel company. And this is like a very core part of like the culture he have at Argus. And trust me, like, we're not intentional and we're not kind of like keeping ourselves accountable to this. It's very tempting to become a pick and shovel company. And I'm honestly very biased here, but I do think, like, you know, building a pick and shovel company is probably much more straightforward than like us trying to be a gaming company. But I just don't think that is the best path forward for like the crypto gaming industry. And that's really why we don't identify as a pick and shovel company.
I'm thinking, I just gave you your next meme to tweet out. It's like the Bart Simpson chalkboard generator, where it's just Argus is not a pick and shovel company.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah.
It's awesome to see you and Argus like lean into being a gaming company, because again, it's not an insult to any people building infrastructure. Like, a lot of it's extremely valuable, but the reality is that for a lot of use cases and a lot of companies, it massively de-risks what you're building, because you're essentially able to establish a venture type portfolio of other protocols and other applications to index your company on. Like, if you're custody or staking or node services, as long as a few of these networks or use cases pan out, if you're good at the infrastructure, it'll work. But it's just a different mindset, because if you're not laser focused on building something the direct to consumer that people want to play or use, at the back of your mind, it's always like, okay, I can always fall back on the infrastructure. So it's like this sense of, you're not the first person I've known to mention this, like, there's this sense of almost complacency that can set in if you are an infrastructure company, because it's like indirect.
Yeah, the incentives are very different, right? I feel like if I'm like, let's say, infrastructure company, the way that I would sell the World Engine would be like, Yeah, like, you know, just like do this, the Neural Engine, maybe not a Neural Engine. Let's say I'm just like, I don't know, like an NFT minting API company, right? Which is like very common. Like these are like dimes a dozen. Everyone's want to be like an NFT minting infrastructure company in crypto games. Their incentives are very different. Their incentives are, you know, increase like AR. And so their incentives are like, okay, your game probably doesn't make sense to have an NFT, but I want you to use my infrastructure anyway so that you will have an NFT, right? I just can't move myself. Like I have like just like a very strong conscience of like the genuine people just trying to make do right by their investors, being do right by their employees, building a great game. And then I'm trying to kind of shoehorn NFTs into their games. And as a result, destroying your creative vision and actually just like influencing the path of their games in the wrong direction. I can't bring myself to do that to people, right? And so with the World Engine, we're very much the case where like, okay, like, you know, if we just don't think like it makes sense for your games to build on a World Engine, like don't build on a World Engine, right? There is like, again, like no incentives for us to like shoehorn a World Engine to people's games in contrast to like, you know, a lot of these pick and shovel companies where like, I don't care if you're, I don't know, a mobile game that have zero reason on like why you need to have an NFT, you're going to use our platform, right? Again, this is a very cynical framing, of course, but like, I think the reality here is that like a lot of crypto gaming pick and shovel companies are like that. They would have these many different upsells and like whatever, and that doesn't make sense for the game companies, but they have to sell them anyway because that's a part of their product suite, right? And like a lot of these game studios will just say, oh, look at this other game studio. They're using our product to do this. You should do the same thing. And they're like, great, because they raise a bunch of money. You can raise a bunch of money too by using the same thing. And I'm like, wait a second. Like, you know, these people didn't even figure out that they really need this. They're just like really experimenting. And this really goes back to like what I'm saying about an hour ago when it comes down to just like, yeah, like in reality right now is that there is no clear playbook for crypto games, and like prescribing people like, you know, certain features or prescribing people certain tools just wouldn't really make sense, because at the end of the day, we are still experimenting. We want to explore these new design spaces, and like we don't want the infrastructure to be the limit. We want the infrastructure to become ingredients, to be tools in a toolbox. And so that's really kind of like how we see the World Engine to be.
I guess going back to rollups, and the mental model of kernel versus distro versus cloud provider, like there's this natural tension, right, that arises in terms of value accrual, like similar to Uniswap protocol versus Uniswap labs, and the mobile wallet similar to the Atom Hub and all these different app chains and Cosmos generally. Like there probably is a tension, and there will continue to be a tension down the line when Celestia, Optimism, Sovereign Labs, like they're building these amazing tools, and like if others are the ones that are actually profiting from them or in a steady state, like with the highest margins, like it creates a little bit of a weird dynamic, right? Where it's like, should we try and cannibalize our customers? So I guess curious how you think about it.
So yeah, I think like when it comes to the like tension here, I would say it all comes down to incentives, right? I think like it really comes down to how the kernel wants to position themselves and how they see their business model to be. It really comes down to how the distro position themselves and like how they see themselves to be for really kind of the, and at the end of the day, the rollup as a service, I feel like, is really kind of dependent on these like underlying stacks to like do right by them, right? I can't speak for the other rollups, obviously, but for the World Engine, we want to make sure that we do right by the rollup as service providers that are building on top of our ecosystem, right? And so how would that entail is with basically staying true to our like open source like ethos, right? Because the failure case here is like, let's say there is a hypothetical rollup distro that basically started off as like open source, and then like they eventually just like, ah, fuck it. Like, you know, we're going to kill the rollup as service that's operating on top of us. And then they just like, okay, like we're going open source, or we're going to BSL or like whatsoever. And that's like shitty, right? That just like, imagine like the amount of trust and like the amount of, I would say, partnership that have been established by those two like layers that would be severed because like, you know, one, the distro just like eventually just like, yeah, you know what? We want to be a rollup service too. And I think this is like why I think it's really important for a rollup as a service provider to do their due diligence in terms of like the people who are building their distro, right? Ask me questions in terms of like how my business model with Argus is going to be as a company, and whether or not I have an incentives, or whether or not I really intend to just kind of, let's say, verticalize the entire stack, right? And I think that will give you a lot of answer as a roll-up service provider on whether or not to support a certain stack, right? So for instance, there are just like, you know, like I'm not going to name names, but like there are a lot of like roll-up ecosystem that are working on their own kernel, they're working on their own distro, and they're also working on their own roll-up as a service provider. And as a result, there's like literally zero incentives for any people to be like building on top of their, like there's not going to be anyone else that want to build their own like roll-up distro on top of their kernel because like they're like verticalizing it. There's no incentives for people to build a roll-up as a service on top of their kernel because they have a roll-up as a service, right? And that's really kind of like why at Argus, again, we are a gaming company. And so we don't want the responsibility of like building our own roll-up kernel. We don't want a responsibility of running an infrastructure company that entails to like a lot of really high expectations from users. Like you gotta have like a high SLA and like you gotta have like solutions engineer, you gotta have like site reliability engineer, make sure that things are not going down, they gotta service your customer and so on and so forth. These are all like way too distracting for us. And so we're very much like comfortable in just being the distro. And we want to encourage people to build more games on that distro. We want to encourage roll-up as a service to build on top of our distro so that more people can have world engine-based blockchain. And so the incentives for us are clear. Like, we want to have more people building on top of world engine by any means necessary, right? And if that means that we work with roll-up as a service and, like, you know, just, like, help them get set up, we spend like engineering resources in like helping this roll-up as a service build a robust infrastructure, adopt a roll engine, and so be it, right? Like our incentives are not driven by selling or making recurring revenues on top of the infrastructure of true roll-up as a service. Our incentive is to get as much adoption as possible and basically eventually building these kind of like ecosystem of developers building on top of the roll engine. That is our end goal. Our end goal is not to make essentially these like, you know, small slices of the pie to roll up service. And I think that's a ball game that is very different. And this is like where we're very excited to just like work with this roll up service providers.
Well said. And I think there's a lot of other things we could talk about with roll ups, but something I know you've been thinking about and a lot of people have been talking and thinking about is the sequencing, right? It's so fundamental to roll ups. And at the moment, it's quite lucrative for a lot of rollups. I'm just curious what you think of the current state of sequencing, maybe in particular around this more recent narrative of, hey, maybe it makes sense to have shared sequencing and have a bunch of different rollups share similar sequencing.
I have a lot of takes with shared sequencers, but I think like the most high level take I have with like shared sequencers is I don't think people have agreed about what is shared sequencer. A lot of people are claiming to become a shared sequencer, but we haven't really seen one that comes up with like, hey, here's like how we're going to implement a shared sequencer. This is how we're going to have like atomic composability around the shared sequencer and so on and so forth. The key thing here that I will say is that like a lot of these like shared sequencer possible designs that people are exploring right now comes with a certain trade-off, right? A lot of people are saying that, oh yeah, shared sequencer will solve atomic composability across rollups and there's not going to be any trade-offs from that. And it's going to be, everyone's life is going to be great, right? That's really the image that I think narrative our people are really saying. But reality here is like shared sequencers do come with a trade-off, right? I think there is a question for like, this is not for gaming because like gaming doesn't really have MEV, but like there is this question of like, okay, who captures the MEV if like you use a shared sequencer? Is it kind of the shared sequencing company, the shared sequencing protocol, or is it still the kind of the execution layers are operating on it? A lot of the answers that I've seen right now is that, oh, shared sequencer captured MEV value and accrue value from there. There are also kind of like things like, okay, if you want to have different block times, if you want to have like a certain runtime properties of the execution layer, those are going to be limited by kind of these like shared sequencing models as well. For instance, with atomic composability, you need to have locks. You need to basically restrict an execution layer from going forward in time before they finish, let's say, these like cross rollup bundles. And that is a trade-off on its own for, let's say, I want to build a gaming rollups that is like have a consistent block time because that is the tick rate of my game. Then we can't use a shared sequencer that imposes locks on top of it because that would disrupt the gameplay experiences. And there's a question of like, okay, if you have this shared sequencer, how are you going to secure the shared sequencer, right? What happens if, let's say, there is a rollup that is shared sequencing there, and it's basically placing locks on a bunch of different rollups and causing things to like grind to a halt? Now you have to introduce like, you know, economic incentives and so on and so forth. A lot of these are very hand-waved right now. There's a lot of people that want to build shared sequencers, but I haven't really seen a concrete implementation, a concrete set of trade-offs that they're willing to take, that they're not willing to take, they're optimizing for what they're not optimizing for. And that's, I think, is the key problem with, like, you know, these like shared sequencers right now. I think it's an open area of research. I haven't really seen a clear path towards it. But like, yeah, I think at the end of the day, how we see it at Argus is that sequencing could be a very interesting model for gaming companies to also capture value. And so I don't necessarily think that they have to be like on like their own sequencer, or they have to be a shared sequencer or whatsoever. But I do think it's another design space for like where there might be interesting ways for these like gaming specific rollups to capture value from. And a lot of that really comes down to like how they explore these design spaces. And I think like for now, a lot of these are really blue sky. A lot of these are really open explorations. But I'm very excited to just see how like people are experimenting with value capture through the sequencing layer. And like right now, what we see is that people are excited about shared sequencers, but I think like not everyone have really thought about the implications of like opting into a shared sequencer set. And like, again, like this is not really their fault. It's really more of the shared sequencer companies or shared sequencer startups not really publishing what this opting into the shared sequencer entails. It's more of like basically advertised as like a silver bullet, which I think like once there is more transparency there and there's more like implementation getting done there, then we'll have more people being able to reason on whether or not they want to opt into shared sequencer or they want to have their own sequencer. But I think, again, at the end of the day, I feel like there are trade-offs with shared sequencers that is important for kind of developers to take into consideration before, like, you know, signing a deal that, hey, we're going to deploy on your shared sequencer. And that's really their take. That's really my take.
Scott, you've spent time in the past at Uniswap. You've spent time at Trail of Bits. I'm curious what you've taken away from these experiences, if there's any in particular, any companies that have stood out.
Yeah, so I do think that is an extreme privilege to basically be able to essentially do a tour of like the crypto space before I go and back full circle to crypto games. And I think the key thing that I learned there is really, and I think this is actually what these two companies share in common, is their obsession towards like engineering rigor and security. I think like at this point, I think like a lot of people really consider Uniswap as this protocol that is like have a lower security risk, and like Trail of Bits as being kind of like a very great auditing firm. And I think like a lot of these, again, like comes down to really just great process and really great engineering rigor within these organizations, right? And I think like a lot of, I think like reality with crypto gaming right now is that just because we're not operating on DeFi, we're not operating on like these like highly, you know, like there's not a lot of like value involved at every single transactions and all of that, that people think about like security as like, I don't know, or security or engineering rigor as, oh yeah, it's like means to an end. I think game development in general, I also had this mindset of like, oh yeah, engineering is a means to an end. You don't really invest a lot in the attention and like making things secure. You just want to make a game that is playable. And I think like I disagree with that. I feel like engineering rigor and like kind of like attention to security in crypto is like very much paramount. I think we've seen other crypto gaming companies in the past where they really treat security as a hindsight. They're really making crazy trade-offs to like, you know, kind of take shortcuts to ship faster. They take shortcuts to just like, oh yeah, like allegedly making the user experience better and all of that while exposing a variety of like security risks or kind of just like a network risk in general. And that ended up causing harm to the larger crypto space as a whole. And I think that's like highly unfortunate, right? And I think like, for me, like, you know, having worked at these companies, it really taught me, you know, like what is great engineering look like and what great security first mindset looks like. And I think like the crypto gaming space has a lot to learn from these companies. And so recently I made this like tweet that every companies that want to like crypto companies that want to go to like mainnet or like launch something that has value on it should get a security engineer in-house or get like a CISO in-house. Because there's so many low-hanging fruits that you can do to just secure your company, right? Let it be from OPSEC or from like smart contract security or application security, network security and whatsoever, that I think like a lot of companies, especially those that are not operating in DeFi, don't really take seriously. And that's really, I feel like, what everyone can learn, right? From like, you know, Uniswap and the Trello Bits is really their kind of like very security first mindset. And I think like I'm excited to just kind of see that more in like crypto games, like decentralized social, NFTs, and so on and so forth, where like for some reason, a lot of these companies see security as a hindsight, or they just don't talk about it at all. Especially with like right now, to give you an example, right? It's like with roll up operations, there are elements of like, okay, like how do you sign transactions for like data bundles and so on and so forth, which involves like managing a private key and stuff like that. I talk with a lot of like, you know, kind of people, and they were just like, oh yeah, just like put a private key on the Docker container and just sign it, which is like, wait, that's a very questionable strategy, right? Because that just opens up a risk of like, what if your like, you know, private key got exposed to due to the vulnerability in your Docker container and stuff like that. And so there's a really like a lot of nuances here that we have to think about. And I think like not enough people in crypto games take security very seriously, which I think is like very unfortunate, right? Because I do think like a lot of these things are not mutually exclusive. Just because you want to optimize for like security doesn't mean you have to trade off like user experience. Like, you know, these things can coexist. These are not trade-offs. It's like the trade-off here is, I think like a lot of these trade-off really is comes down to like opportunity costs. Like a lot of these like crypto gaming companies sees like running crypto infrastructure or thinking about doing the crypto part securely as an opportunity cost. And they kind of optimize for a different thing instead. But I don't know, don't think they should optimize for a different thing instead, because like these kind of security postures, these security practices, this like approach to security is paramount when you want to deal with like, you know, user having value on your application on your chain. And you can't just like swipe it off just because like, you know, you're not like a DeFi company, which is like why I'm like very excited to just like have more people who are building crypto game primitives just take an audit, right? I think like, we haven't seen like a lot of these crypto gaming companies that built like these novel contracts or whatsoever take an audit on their smart contracts, which is like very, very, for me, in my opinion, very dangerous. And like, I think we should expect more from kind of these like crypto gaming companies or a decentralized company to do have an audit if they want to have user value. And like, yeah.
My last question, just to wrap things up, is you've interacted a lot with a ton of different crypto VCs, and I don't know if you've actually worked on one. I don't remember. But I think it's clear that you've thought a lot about just investors and the landscape. And I think we could talk for a while about this, but without getting into specifics, what do you actually want? Or what would be, like, what helps you? What do you look for in an investor? Is it someone that has the technical chops? Is it to help you solve difficult research problems? Is it someone that's sort of there to help with strategy and recruiting? Is it someone that's just a friend and can be a phone call away? In your experience so far, like, what's been the best?
Yeah. So I think my biggest, I don't know like why crypto founders don't talk about this enough, but I think this has been like very much the case for traditional VC investing, is that remember at the end of the day, you're not marrying the fund, you're marrying the deal partner, right? I think like, when I'm basically doing the round, I already have a specific person in mind that I feel like, okay, these are the kind of people that I want to partner with, instead of just like, okay, just like the fun kind of reputation, because it's a very high variance thing. Like, let's say you have two partners in the same fund, the way that they operate is very different. And then you have to realize that when you're dealing with these like funds, you're most likely going to be interacting with the one that owns the deal within their fund. You're not going to be interacting with their entire kind of like platform team. You're not going to be interacting with their entire like deal team, right? And so I think it's very important for companies or to just kind of our founders kind of really think about who are really they are partnering and whether or not they can work with those people. Because at the end of the day, they are going to be the one who's going to influence the fund to help you do things, to ask you to, like the fund to support you in certain ways, right? And that's really what I feel like is very important to take into considerations when like kind of basically raising, right? It's like, don't just take term sheets just because of the fund name, but take into consideration who is going to be your point of contact in the fund, who is a deal partner, right? And this is like a lot of the things that I think like for first time founders are like non-obvious, or like people or founders that have not been like in the other side of the table, is that you don't realize that you're not going to be marrying the fund, you're going to be marrying the deal partner, right? And then the deal partner can influence other people in the fund to do things for you, but if the deal partner is like checked out, then like you're not going to be able to get anything done by that fund. And so that's like one thing, right? The second thing I would say from a founder's perspective is that, again, like different founders have different level of expectations from their investors. I am very much in the camp of like, you know, I like the investors that are like, respond when we need help with, but like, you know, don't intervene with when like, you know, we're trying to do a strategic decision and like all of that. They can provide advice. And of course, like they're having everyone's ticket is like always useful, but don't try to lift through their portfolio companies. There's a lot of like, I think like, I'm not going to name names, but there's a lot of crypto investors out there that are like, yeah, I'm not a founder. I don't want to be a founder, but I want to like basically live the life of a founder by like kind of like influencing strategic decisions within the companies, right? This is like what I like to define as like investors that wants to live through the portfolio companies. I generally feel like these are the worst kind of investors because like they will be like telling you you're doing the wrong thing and they'll tell you like X, Y, and Z. And like, I just don't think that's like how you should support your portfolio companies. Like the moment that you're investing in a founder, you are placing a bet on the founder and trusting that they know the best path forward for their company. And you're not like basically just like trying to use the founders like your employee to execute on things and just like, you know, make them run around for you. And so that is, I think, like, you know, the kind of like, I think like venture investors I personally don't like. And I just tell my friends, like, don't take money from investors like this. But yeah, at the end of the day, different founders have different preferences for their kind of investors. Like some of them will like investors that are overly hands-on, like the one that actually wants to like make strategic decisions with a company. But like for most founders that I talk to, especially second time founders, they prefer like investors. They're like in touch with the team. You can like talk with them. They come to the office. They kind of like go on like weekly meetings, give for like useful advice and give useful intros. But they're not overly hands-on on like product decisions or strategic decisions to a point where they're like, okay, like telling founders what to do, right? So that's really kind of like my take on these like crypto VC thing. Of course, there are like these like variety of value adds that like a VC will try to offer to their company. And I think like the best value add is to just be there and available to the founder when they need to bounce ideas or they need advice on something, right? I think like at the end of the day, there are just like some parts of the crypto VC platform that are scalable and some of them are not. So for instance, like I think like expecting a fund to always be like basically designing your product or doing mechanism design for your DeFi protocol is just not very realistic because like, I think we know the prime example of this where like, okay, like someone take this fund because their previous like partner helped this one company design X, Y, and Z. And like now they're expecting the same thing for your company. The reality here is that like, that's not always the case. I think it's more of a, like, I think like research is not a scalable thing. Like these hands-on protocol design, mechanism design are not a scalable thing. You can get advices from these people. You can like get them to give thought and advice on like how to approach things, but you can't get them to basically treat them like, oh yeah, this is an extra employee in my company, right? They're like, treat them more as like advisors. And I think like you can get advisors even without being, you know, like them like basically investing on you. You can just like nurture snap people on Twitter. So that's really kind of my take, right? At the end of the day, like, you know, bias to investors is just like, you know, want to do good by their portfolio company. They have like, you know, a chip on their shoulder to do well by their portfolio companies. Those are, I think, the best funds to work with. And then like, just take into consideration that a lot of crypto funds have a large portfolio like base. Like a lot of them like have like, you know, 20 plus, 30 plus, or even like some of them are spraying and praying and have a shit ton of like portfolio companies. And they're not going to be able to support every single one of them like super hands on. And so that is like something that you have to keep in mind when you're choosing a deal partner, right? So like, are like, do they already have too much on their plate? Are they like, okay, they want to build a very specific set of like ecosystem of companies that they can cross-pollinate and collaborate and all of that? These are all like hidden incentives that I think a lot of founders are not kind of particularly familiar with that like anyone, and I'm including you, who have been on the other side of the table might have seen happen in the wild. So like, yeah.
Yeah, I like asking this question because you always get a really broad perspective from folks. The only thing I would add is I do think it's helpful if VCs that have expertise in one specific tactical thing give feedback on how to do that one specific thing, whether it could be research, it could be marketing, it could be comms, it could be like stuff like that. But I think I would agree when they're trying to opine or force their vision onto a product roadmap or broader company strategy, that's when it becomes problematic. But I do think it can be helpful if they ask questions about those things.
Yeah, 100%. 100%,
with the understanding that it's just other perspectives. Because I'll be honest, I like to do some of those things. I hope I don't come across as like, hey, you should do X, Y, Z. It's more like, hey, like, how do you think about ABC? But I can see how it'd be very annoying.
No, I definitely agree with that, right? I think like the key part here is like, I think the best job that like a deal partner can do is ask the right questions, right? I think like some of my best investors are people that just ask amazing questions, even if they don't have domain expertise. They're just a very good listener. They're very like critical in a good way, in a sense that they actually try to stress test your ideas, stress test your like strategy on their head, and then kind of communicate that by asking the right set of questions, helping founders think about things the right way, instead of like, oh, my previous portfolio companies does this, you should do the same thing. This is like the problem with some of the, like some like, you know, investors that are like, oh, they made a great exit once, or they made a great deal once, and now they're trying to influence all of their companies to do the same thing that the successful company does, without realizing that like different companies just will have like, you know, different paths to success, right? And like, I think it's like very important to just like have people that knows what they're doing, but also knows the right way to communicate it to their founders, and also kind of be able to take pushback from founders in a good way. Right. And I think like, again, like all of this comes down to also these people who are going to be doing this are not going to be like some random guy at a fund. It's going to be your deal partner. So I wouldn't like basically expect, let's say like you take a fund, like you're taking money from a fund that, let's say, have a great research partner at, let's say, I don't know, like maybe Rollup Design or ZK or whatever. Right. And then like, but like that person is not your deal partner. He's not the one who is sponsoring your deal. Then quite honestly, you're not going to get as much attention and help from that person. I think like a lot of funds likes to portray it such that like, oh yeah, this person's going to be always by your side. He's going to be like, you know, coming to your office, supporting you on this. So like, that's not a reality. It's like almost always like if that person is not your deal partner, or they're not one of the person who's sponsoring your deal internally, they're not getting the credits for that deal. That deal is not attributed to them. They don't have extra carry exposure to that deal or whatsoever. These person are not going to spend as much time as like someone who is actually sponsoring your deal, right? The person who's like sponsoring your deal is like homies with that person and can like, oh yeah, get ask a favor. Like, sure, maybe you'll get some extra help, but like at the end of the day, it's also important to just like kind of take into these incentives in mind. And, you know, again, the best advice I can give is really just like marry the deal partner, not the fund.
Totally. And I think really good advice for new founders in crypto. Well, Scott, this has been really great conversation. We've been on for almost 2 hours, so I will stop things here. I think it was a really covered a lot of ground. So yeah, thanks again for coming on.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.